You're listening to DraftKings Network.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vanderkoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Big Suey. Presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
Welcome to Metal Archivist 31. Is it 31? I think it's 31.
You're just making up numbers now.
I'm just making up numbers now. Amin, that is quite a beard you got there.
Why, thank you.
you are welcome. I'm looking at that, right? Looking very Florida. Are you down there?
I am. I'm live from the Clevelander Hotel. I don't know if you guys can hear the thumping bass. Literally, my chair is shaking. Everything, like there's a bottle of water on my desk here, and it's like the scene from Jurassic Park where they see because the T-Rex is walking, they see the little ripples in the water.
Nice. Last week, I was at the SAC Symposium in Washington, D.C. from the Drake Group, which is an organization that is committed to college sports reform. And it was a pretty amazing confluence of events, because not only was there that conference taking place, but 2 days earlier, I believe that there was a news story that Duke University had filed Mike Krzyzewski's compensation for 2020 at $13.4 million annually. And then just a day and a half later, we had the Nick Saban Jimbo Fisher thing going on as well. And I just couldn't stop but help to think about how suddenly, now that the players have an opportunity to make money, now we've got issues. And now we're accusing, these mega coaches are accusing each other of buying players. Haven't they been buying players for decades?
Yeah. Why did we make Blue Chip? Why do we think that came out in the 90s? Come on.
Outstanding Larry Bird pull right there, by the way.
This is why we made Blue Chips.
This is why
we made Blue Chips.
Yeah.
What we end up with here is all of these different branches are bringing us to the tree, right? Which is, there's no way out for college sports. And when we talk about this as the mercy killing, I don't see any other way to go forward with college sports. And one of the things about the symposium that I found really interesting was that the data that came forward saying that while everybody is celebrating the 50th anniversary of Title IX, 90% of schools don't even comply with it, which I did not know.
Yeah. That, I was floored by that. I thought for sure there was a typo somewhere. I mean, you knew people were skirting around it, but to say 90% were not in compliance, 9 out of 10 schools,
Yeah.
That's what, 270 out of the 300 some odd D1 colleges are just, yeah, we don't rock with that.
Yeah, we'll just scoff a lot. But not a shock to you, Kate.
We have, in the sports world, we talk about this off and on all sports calendar because of stories that come up, whether it's talking about the way black athletes are treated in the college game, the way female athletes are treated, the way all quote-unquote student athletes are treated. We are at this point now where, to use a very basic metaphor, it's like the house cannot be renovated. Like, and that is what we're seeing, all of like the, oh yeah, okay, now we'll give him some NIL money. Now we'll open up a transfer portal. I mean, what does the house look like right now? Some sort Frankenstein machine that you can't even live in. I mean, we are approaching the point where needing to raise this thing to the ground is inevitable.
And even that is kind language, Kate, because so many times when we speak about this in America all the time, because we believe in the movies that we've got one last shot to make it happen. And you see when we talk about climate change and global warming, that, you know, it's not too late. It's too late. We talk about all of these different terms. And at the symposium, they constantly were talking about this as reform. I don't think this can be reformed. It's like police reform. You need something different, something completely new.
Yeah, and just to go back to the text exchange that we were all on last week when you were at the conference, Howard, and talking about, you know, 90% of schools don't comply with Title IX. I mean, the whole point of the NCAA taking over women's sports was so that they could institute ways to not comply with Title IX. I mean, if we want to go back just a little mini history lesson, because I feel like this is crucial to understanding why last year you saw Sedona Prince's TikTok videos go viral at the inequities, the shocking inequities at the NCAA tournament. Just like a quick detour back to history, back to 1982, right, is when the NCAA took over from the AIAW, which was the governing body for women's sports. Before that, the NCAA had spent 10 years with a war chest attempting to get Title IX overturned. The day Title IX passed, you have guys like Bear Bryant in Congress people's offices going, "Do you know what this is going to do to our sport?"
Sounds kind of familiar.
For 10 years, they were trying to legally get Title IX overturned because they didn't want to share with women's sports. They finally realized that it was inevitable. It was locked in. Title IX was happening. And the next best thing was to say, if we don't also govern women's sports, they might legitimately get 50% of the resources because we won't oversee them and we won't be able to like pull our little rabbit out of a hat tricks that we do. So they had a vote and they took over women's sports. And that is the fox guarding the hen house. They said, on that day in 1982, they said, "You know what? We are gonna do right by the letter of the law. You know, like a third of our seats of power will go to women, a third will go to men, and then a third will remain open for the best candidate." What do you think happened to that last third of seats? And that is
who
the
those
history.
Third?
Yes, and to this day, it is still. You look across the NCAA; it is at best 66% governed by men every single place you look. So it's like that is the history of the NCAA governing women's sports. So when we hear that no one is complying with Title IX, that is not a bug of the system, right? That is the way it has been designed on the college sports level.
It's insane. I never knew that. I never knew that. Like I'm trying to think of a better analogy than fox guarding the hen house. I don't think one exists because it is literally the predator and the prey, right?
Yeah.
And saying that, you know, hey, we don't need oversight because I'm going to oversee myself. On Basketball Illuminati this week.
Sounds like policing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right? We talked about the idea of the NBA, when it comes to refereeing, they grade their own refs, and the refs have a 95% success rate. And it says, according to whom? According to people who are paid by the NBA. It doesn't make sense. I said, if you talk about the lottery, they say, oh, no, we have a third party watching this. It's called Ernst & Young, right? Same thing with the voting for awards and all that. All of these different areas where we're comfortable outsourcing the oversight. But when it comes to this particular thing, which is most integral to the integrity of the game, we're like, we got this. Don't worry about it. It's the same thing here. It's like you have this rule because these universities weren't not because it wasn't fair. The resources were not being divvied up in a fair manner. And so your answer is to make the same people who are keeping these people out to be in charge of the divvying up of the resources. That just sounds dumb.
Yeah. We can come up with a dozen examples of where the NCAA has created a facade that has been bought hook, line, and sinker by the general sporting public to perpetuate just like the bankruptcy of athletes and to milk them for all they are worth.
Yeah. Can we talk about the lack of Black players in Major League Baseball for a quick second? Because I think this is for you, Kate. There are under 7% Black players in Major League Baseball now. And we all know the reason why. I mean, obviously, it's very, very simple, right? It's a money game. Baseball invests in the Dominican Republic and Latin America, and then they invest in colleges. That's where they get their players. So therefore, the number of Black players is down, you know, it's going to be 5%, and then soon it'll be like zero. Who knows? So baseball has been working through all these different ways. Like the biggest problem here is that the NCAA, you know, baseball is a non-revenue sport. And so, you know, Black baseball in the NCAA, I think it's like 2%. So Major League Baseball, there had been this movement with Dave Dombrowski and baseball's blue ribbon panels in the mid-2000s, in the mid-2000s to come forward and maybe contribute. Why don't we do some, we'll do some scholarships. We'll, you know, create some revenue so some of those slots can go to these African-American players. And the NCAA, and none of it ever happened. So I remember one time talking to some baseball and saying, well, hey, why, whatever happened to that initiative? And they blamed Title IX. And it was, well, we can't fund a couple of scholarships for minority players here because then we'd have to do something for Title IX. I said, well, then fund some of those guys too. So yeah. what's the issue? And immediately that whole thing got shot down. So to your point earlier about how the NCAA was going out of its way to police Title IX by controlling it, excellent example right there. And so now you have, so the two areas where you need support, where you need to increase the number of African-American players to create prospects, and then you need the support to create and to be more of an advocate for women's sports, both lose.
Yep.
Both of them lose under the umbrella of the NCAA.
Even this week, we see the news come out about the U.S. Women's National Team and the Men's National Team standing shoulder to shoulder, signing a joint labor agreement. And the way it gets framed is that the men are giving charity to the women, that in order to lift up women, we have to take from the pocket of the men. I mean, we can probably do a Meadowlarkers on the U.S. Women's National Labor Agreement, like down the road, but it's the framing that is interesting to me. And it mirrors the framing of Title IX, which is that we are taking, it's a zero-sum game. We are taking right from men and giving to women. And then if we are forced to do that, we will then make sure you know to blame the women. And that is the framing that has existed since Title IX's inception. And like, no, and I think part of the conversation that we should have here today is like, is the question that women were asking in the 70s and 80s, which is, do we want our version of college sports to look like what the men have done? Because when Walter Byers started the NCAA in 51, 52, I mean, he was already exploiting the men's side of the game. And like the women could see that. And the women were coming through the lens of having to report up through like phys ed. So it was like part of the education department. And they're looking over at the men and they're like, yeah, okay, they have TV contracts and there's more money and there is upside to that, but the exploitation of the athlete, they could already see happening. And they were like, maybe we don't want our version of college sports to look like that. And that's the question I kind of ask in general, is like, we only have one version of college sports, which is the exploitative, make money at all costs. Is like, is that the kind we need?
Is that the only model? But then yes. Again, this is a story. By the way, Kate, are you wearing a hoodie right now?
It's like a fake hoodie. It's like a half hoodie.
It's like a half hoodie because it's got the with the black white trimming. At first, I thought it was a karate robe, and you were willing to beat somebody's ass right now.
Hi. I thought it was a chef. A chef outfit.
I can't tell if this is good for this particular piece of clothing I own or if I should retire it.
You should absolutely keep it because I thought you were just going to like f*** somebody up. I was like, she's here to do battle today.
That's right. I
thought you were cooking. But either way, you're absolutely cooking right
cooking
now.
Cooking
right?
Well, though, he said. Cooking well.
Yes.
Cooking like well.
And in charge of other people cooking.
Yes.
And in charge of other people cooking, right? So, no, it's 100%. And this goes back to what we were saying in some of the earlier Meadowlarks about storytelling, is that so in order to find equity, the structure stays the same. The storytelling stays the same, but the people are different. So we kill as many people as we killed before in film, we just give a woman the gun. Mm-hmm. And so now we tell the exact same story. We're going to have the exact same structure where the men were being exploited, but now we'll just exploit the women as well. And we'll call that progress.
Yep.
And so, and this is exactly where you run into the, can we create something new question, where people are so, it's almost like one of the things that people say all the time when we're doing our EP groups, when we're doing the Costa show, let's make sure that perfect is not the enemy of good. And constantly the argument has been, well, and we did this. This was an argument. This was like a running theme at the Drake Group Symposium in DC last week as well, which was, you know, if we do this, you know, yeah, this is going to harm or this is going to create more problems. It's like, well, wait a minute. These arguments that we can't reform or build or destroy and create something new, assume that what we have right now is actually working.
Mm-hmm.
What we have right now does not work at all.
Mm-mm. Right. And I think that's the interesting thing for me is with NIL, there is an element of, I hope, of equality through just cutting out the middleman, right? Instead of saying, here's the money. The money goes to the administrators who then decide where the money is most deserved. And as we pointed out, overwhelmingly, oh, men's sports. Oh, how'd that work out, right? But with the NIL, you have an opportunity, at least on the high end, for the money to go around that middleman.
For the Paige Beckers of the world to like cash in the same way that a top male player would cash in. But this is another example. Talk about the fox guarding the hen house. The NCAA is the one starting to create these NIL guidelines. Why are they the ones who are going to set this up? They have been the ones who stood in the way of this for forever.
I think the interesting thing is what gives me hope and makes me optimistic, which is not a familiar place for me, about the NIL is when I see this conversations between Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban, and I hear Dabo Swinney talking about this is going to destroy college football and all that. I'm like, okay, if the bad guys are all complaining about this thing, maybe this is something that's going to be transformative in the way, because they fear it. What we're hearing from them, it's not, oh, you pay who or who gets paid what. It's the fear of the lack of control and the fear that it's going to create a new economy that is going to subvert them, that's going to cut
reduce
them out.
Their power.
Yeah, not only reduce their power, Howard, reduce their money.
Because if
the money can go straight to the talent, then why am I paying Nick Saban the highest paid guy in the state of Alabama, a state employee in the state of Alabama? Why am I giving him all these millions of dollars to go get the talent so that they can be number one when the talent is being dictated to independently from that? It cuts him out of the power for sure. But at some point, maybe it's not immediate, but the ripple effect down the line is, oh yeah, why am I paying you all this money when I can just go right to the kid and land him wherever I want to land him?
If you can go right to the kid, what is stopping the players from staying? Like, eventually you could actually create, if you really wanted to, just to get really, really radical, you could create essentially a rival league to the NFL.
So you got a bunch of post-grads just hanging around? I'm in my seventh year, getting my third doctorate.
Well, what's stopping you from creating, I mean, if we're going to argue that the players are employees, Why do they have to stop working after 4 years?
Okay, you want to get crazy? You guys want to get crazy? All right. You have college sports that have some of the most dedicated fan bases, you know, in any sport, probably, definitely domestically, maybe in the world, right? What if I told you that Florida could have Tim Tebow for a 15-year career, right? We completely detach it from education.
Totally.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that could
yeah,
be
we
crazy.
Should. I mean, that needs to be. I mean, that needs to be what we do. Is you detach it from education, you charge the minor league team, the Florida Gators, the University of Florida charges them a licensing fee to keep the name and the logo, and you spin them off, and they can be a minor league club team with whatever clubs they want to have. Because the thing that makes me less optimistic about NIL is to Howard's point earlier, which is, yeah, you're still living in the same script, right? You've just sort of given someone else the gun, but you have
and that money is not coming from the school.
Yeah, and it's still an exploitation and a deep commercialization of sports that is still tied to education, which creates all of these really strange interactions for student athletes. Interactions is the best way to put it. But the fundamental issue is that most student athletes I know, and granted, most of them are women, the experience of being a student athlete is nothing like anticipated. It is all kinds of power struggle, power imbalance, and that does not get fixed by the NIL having a little bit of money to toss around to some people, more money to others. Whereas if we're fundamentally changing college sports, then the number one step is to detach them from education, because that is the most asinine thing that we ever did in the first place.
Well, I disagree with that. Because that was the argument, especially when it comes to Black people. That was the argument when it to integration, which was you being on a PWI, on a predominantly white institution, this was going to provide you access to the larger world that you currently don't have access to. I mean, that's the reason why, if you're looking at the integration of college sports, that's why, of colleges, that's why they didn't go to the HBCUs and get the scientists and the sociologists and the history professors. They went, majors, they went and got the players. Mm-hmm. And so there was a point where the value of being an athlete on campus, there was value to it. There was a larger point. But to your point today, does that model hold? That model hasn't held for 35 years or more. That model has been dead for most of my lifetime. So the real question is, to me, are you willing to surrender the idea that there's an educational component to this? Is it time to say goodbye to that completely? And most people want to say no, whether it's because of nostalgia or out of practicality. No, they're here for an education.
I agree with the historical point about playing sports at a school. I mean, that's why we have high school sports.
And that's right.
Internationally, you know, when I went to play in Ireland, a lot of my teammates, they played sports with like Trinity University in Ireland. It just wasn't a commercialized business the way it is here. So what I'm suggesting is asinine is the business, the way that the business has been like artificially like attached to an education system. And obviously we know all the reasons for it, to siphon off all of the benefits and the amateurism status. I mean, that is a huge block to our game plan here, to remove education, because then you can't hide behind amateurism and you can't hide behind that when it comes to injuries. And so there are a lot of hurdles to clear for our future, quote unquote, minor leagues of college sports.
Howdy, folks. It's Mike Ryan. I'm living the gimmick right now. The playoffs have already gotten me, and we're a couple of days into it. It's like a playoff equinox that's going on right now. It's ridiculous. And if you're like me, you like rooting on your team. Trust me, I just bought 3 for my wife, daughter, and myself for game 1. I live it. Because I've been out there. I've been out in those streets. I've been panicking last second trying to find deals. And then when I eventually settle on something, I'm not sure if it's the lowest price out there, and I'm getting just totally blitzed with surprise fees. Well, thankfully, Game Time takes it out of the equation. All the fees are up front. There's no surprises. You get to see what your seat looks like. It's amazing the technology we have these days, but Game Time has your back always. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app right now, create an account, and use code DAN for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code DAN for $20 off. Download the Game Time app today. Last minute deals, lowest price, guaranteed. Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Let me play devil's advocate to the idea that I got excited about 5 minutes ago. Right? Here's the problem. Number one, I believe that most college sports fans are fans subconsciously. I don't know if they know this, but part of the allure is the fact that you're watching basically 18 and over. I'm watching young people who don't have any other options in life but to do this. That they don't have agency. That they can't just go anywhere, right? That they can't be traded. Even the concept of the transfer portal, probably, I submit to you that if we did a poll of college football fans, they would be anti-transfer portal, unless, of course, the transfer is coming to their school, in which case they're all for it. But as in general, they're not for it. And so by openly commercializing it, by removing the illusion of amateurism, that these are just hot young teens waiting to do your bidding, right? Like, that takes away the allure for the fan base. This is not a defense of the current system, but, you know, Kate, I was just thinking about when you asked, why does it have to be this way?
Well, that's the psychology of the sport. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and also the psychology as well is that you, superstar point guard, are making the same choice through the same structure as me, fan who wants to be a journalism major. That we're in this together for the same reasons. And therefore you're representing me and representing the school the same way I am representing the school. And that all falls apart. And the transfer portal absolutely helps that fall apart. The question, to Kate's point once again, and it's the best point, it's what this is really all about, is there an educational component to any of this? And if there's an educational component, are you going to do what it takes to preserve the educational component? Because that's why they're here.
Was there ever an educational component? A real one,
yes.
not just one to the facade, but an actual educational component. When did that exist?
Well, it exists now. I mean, I think yes, it does. If you're not a revenue basketball or football player, the club level education versus athletic or / athletic piece is very much alive. There are all kinds of different places at the college level where that model does exist to a certain extent, but then it just falls completely apart when you start adding empire to it, the whole thing collapses. It collapses to a point that where we're at now, which is everybody's laughing at this because it's so completely distant from what its initial mission was. And I mean, I'm not really arguing with you. I'm saying that what we're really talking about, what we've really hit, is the complete tipping point of theory versus practice. That it's so far gone that, I mean, there was a time in the 40s and the 50s where you had to teach at the school to coach. I mean, all of it's gone. It's all dead.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, this is the fundamental question I keep asking myself about what we can save about college sports. Like, what of the model is worth saving? If we try to break it down, is one of the most important things to save, is it the connection of whatever the future team is to the school? Is the connection we have to save that the athletes have to go to that school? Do we have to find a bridge between the fans' allegiance? And this to me is the bridge that we have to find, because I don't think the other things are tenable anymore. I think everyone has seen what the model is. So if we say, well, we still want to have our athletes go to school, you're just going to fall back into the same traps that you've fallen into. The bridge we have to build is, how do we continue the fan allegiance to whatever the future version of college sports is if they are not tied to the educational institution in the way that everyone has for generations accepted it will be? Because it will no longer be baked into it. Like, I'm going to school with these guys. They're my classmates. We're in this together. Or I'm an alma mater and they are currently at my alma mater. Like, we are going to have to build a different bridge to the connection point.
But isn't it really like a trade school? I'm Carmelo Anthony. I'm a basketball major. Right? I mean, that's right. The only reason Carmelo Anthony went to college is because he couldn't go pro yet because of the collusion between the NCAA and the NBA in terms of the age rule.
Well, that hadn't, no, that's not.
He no, went, no, because LeBron went pro yeah, without yeah. going. So that was the next year.
He
next
had a
year.
Choice. No, the answer is because Syracuse gave him an offer he couldn't refuse.
That's also true, right? So, but seriously, but let's ask, exactly, right, 20 years earlier. But let's ask the question, what is wrong with being a basketball genius and going to school to hone your basketball genius?
I think there's nothing wrong with it. I think that's what we've been doing in college basketball for decades. The problem has become when there are more viable options, right? So up until 2005, starting in really in 1995 with Kevin Garnett, because before Garnett, it had been a decade plus, maybe two decades. I think Daryl Dawkins might have been the last one to go straight to the pro. So Kevin Garnett in 95 kind of opened up the floodgates. And for 10 years, there was a better option than majoring in basketball at Georgetown or at Duke or at Kentucky. It was, I'm just going to go right to my job place, in the same way that a kid who's very gifted at programming and coding doesn't, probably won't have to waste time going to college, can get a job right now in Silicon Valley.
Or won't waste time going to grad school, just into the business.
Right, right, exactly. So the age restriction, in essence, what it did was it created a monopoly for college basketball of, oh, do you want to do this for a living? You have to come through us. There are no other options. Yeah, sure, you go to the G League and make $10,000, $15,000. Good luck doing that. Right, riding in buses. Oh, yeah, you could go overseas to where many of these leagues don't speak English and they don't have any kind of infrastructure to look after you. Sure, you could go ahead and knock yourself out. So they really, in essence, had a monopoly. Now, what's happened in the last few years, is, and I believe this is tied to why we have an NIL now, a formalized NIL, is the idea that there are other options, that the G League Ignite program is a real life option that people are taking advantage of, and you get compensated and you get trained better than you would going to college. The NBL down in Australia has a formalized program to attract, develop, and prepare high school American players for the next level. And so now you have the NIL that's like, oh, no, we can get you money too. Stay here. Don't go to the G League and don't go to Australia. I think all of these things are the examples of how outside innovation is dragging evolution along from college. But the question becomes, what's next? Like, what is the unintended consequence of the NIL? Because you know it's coming.
Well, sure. Well, right now, the argument of unintended consequences, this whole idea of buying players, that there's going to be some, what was never intended for incentive. Of course, it's intended for incentive. All money is intended to incentivize. But the one thing that the colleges always had in their favor that the G League and that playing overseas could not compete with is the visibility of the TV contract. That everybody, the difference between baseball, basketball, and football has always been that in the minor leagues in baseball, they call them the Bushes. Nobody's ever heard of you until you get to the big leagues. But in basketball and football, we've been waiting for you since freshman year. Mm-hmm. We've been watching you on TV your entire college career. We saw Michael Jordan hit the jumper against Georgetown, and we're waiting to see what was going to happen. And that all of that sort of goes away if you're a high school senior, and then suddenly you're going to just disappear to Melbourne, Australia, or you're going to go to Sydney, and you're gone, and that's it. And then you come back when you're good.
There could be some middle ground before there's a TV contract for the G League that hits the airwaves, because, or whatever they're called when that happens, because the more talent they get, the more likely it's going to be streaming. So we're in this weird place where it's like,
that's right,
everyone's still on the NCAA ship because they're like, we're on the ship and it's still afloat and we have the TV contracts. It's like, but we know that the ship really isn't going anywhere, and people need, I mean, in my opinion, right? Because like one other point while Amin was talking about that I'll chime in with here, when you're, I was just thinking fundamentally, what coaches are good at the college level, very little of it is actually what an athlete needs you to be good at. Mm-hmm. So it's like all of it is kind of, all of it is like the wires are crossed, right? If you look at the skill set of a coach, it's like, how many of those things does an athlete actually care about? Oh, you're good at raising money with donors? Oh, cool. You're good at, you know, you're good at press conferences? Okay.
There's only two things you should care about. You're going to care about two things: your ability to attract more talent and your ability to hone my skill.
Yep. Yep.
The I would argue it's not even attract more talent. Your ability to put me in a position where I look the best, right? They don't, you know, they're guys that don't even get their skills honed. There's just like,
that's
okay,
true.
We mm-hmm. played for Kentucky and we weren't terrible, and that's good enough to make me go first round. But I'd argue with you guys, there's another thing at play that even removes the need to be on a Duke or Kentucky to be on TV. The ultimate democratization of this, the internet. Zion Williamson was a bigger star off of Instagram than he ever was from Duke or even the NBA, I'd argue. LaMelo Ball, he had a vagabond prep career, right? He went and played in Lithuania, and he went and played in Australia and got hurt almost immediately. But he was the biggest star of his draft class because of social media, because of a show that he did with his family on Facebook, because of his Instagram videos. They don't even need the structure anymore for the exposure. We got the exposure part.
Well, but don't they? I mean, let's put it this way. You're 100% right about all of that if you're talking about the very top head of the pin. But if you're talking about the mid first rounder, the late first rounder, the second rounder, and back when the NBA was a 7 or 10 round draft, those guys absolutely need some sort of structure. But do they need this one?
Right.
You know, do they need this? And also the other piece of all of this too, that before we cut Amin loose to let him go do whatever Amin thinks he's going to be doing.
Very Amin.
Miami.
Very Amin. The other piece of this is, they let this happen by compensating those coaches beyond recognition in the late 80s, early 90s with the shoe contracts, when every player had to wear the coach's shoe. You know, when Jim Boeheim had the contract with Nike and suddenly every Syracuse player had to wear Nikes or whatever school had those deals. That level of distance, you can't really get that back in the current structure. There's no way to bring that back. I mean, empires do not surrender voluntarily.
Yeah, this seems like a nice segue out for me. So
yes,
this,
and Kate and I are going to go into overtime on two questions that I want to ask her.
All right, let's do it.
Amin, we'll see you later. Thanks for playing. We have some lovely parting gifts for you.
Bye, Amin.
So Kate, question number one, is it possible to have a structure of anything close to equity when you have Mike Krzyzewski making $13.4 million?
Yeah. I mean, the obvious answer to that is no. And it's not so much that like cliched knee jerk reaction that most people have, which is like, well, he brings tons of money to Duke. And the pure economic standpoint is that Mike Krzyzewski is worth that money. That completely misses like the historical backdrop of the NCAA and where that value was built over generations. Like if you're really a student of the game, or if you want to understand how the NCAA works, like you really have to go read about it and read about like the first lawsuit by like, you know, like whatever, not Texas A&M, but something like that out down in Texas, and how the NCAA developed the term student athlete so that they would not have to pay workers comp. And so it's like these things,
the
term student athlete did not develop from like Darwin's evolution, because that's what student athletes are. It is a fundamentally created term to defend against having to pay.
They've always been here to work without being called workers.
So it's like, so all of that is like, all of that builds up over decades to a point where you've got so much money in the games that you can pay Mike Krzyzewski. Mike Krzyzewski's worth $13.5 million. It's like, on the backs of what? And that's where we find ourselves. And it's like, it's getting to the point, maybe it has been to the point, but in my world, I guess, where it's, you know, you're at the 50th anniversary of Title IX and you're taking inventory, and everyone wants to think that Title IX was so great for women's sports, and you're like, have you looked lately?
Yeah, and that's my second question for you, is you seem to know through osmosis, the prescience that that's where I was going with the next question. The next question is this: how do you celebrate where we're at when we know what we know? Are you the, for me, I always call myself, I'm just the troublemaker.
Yeah.
When people always say to me, like when people talk about race in the United States, they can only do it through two lenses. Well, get over it, or things are better than they were. And it's very similar to Title IX. Look at the gains, look at the gains, look at the gains we've made. How do you assess as you go through this year of anniversary with what you know and what you see going forward?
Well, whenever I think about Title IX, I, like many young women who were raised in the 90s, I think about my own mom, because she fell into that gap where she's going to high school in like the late 60s, early 70s, loved playing sports growing up, but then, you know, it was like a hockey cheerleader in high school, like, because she was like, I guess I'll do something. And so I'm very careful of saying that, like, I recognize that because of our system, Title IX put forth certain like structural mile markers that allowed me to play sports. But I also really don't want to look at Title IX without looking at the whole history of women's sports. And people, like, the more you read about it, the more you recognize the impact that Title IX had that was maybe not intended. You know, some of it I already articulated, that Title IX led to the NCAA staging a coup and taking over women's sports. And is that a future for women's sports that has turned out well for women's sports? I guess we're supposed to assume, because we're like rubbing shoulders with the men on the NCAA side, that this is the best version of sports we can get as women, versus a world in which in the 60s and early 70s, women were governing themselves. And, you know, I think about this a lot when it comes to the WNBA and the NBA. And it's like, yes, I'm grateful, but we also have to acknowledge, like, there's, you know, the phrase, like, the maw of compromise here. Like, Title IX has led to a place where in some ways women have more opportunities, but in other, the society continues to believe that women have been given everything, as opposed to acknowledging that women have fought to play sports all along, and that history is never acknowledged. The only history that's acknowledged is one when you partner with men.
And well, that is the reason, exactly. And that is the reason why I was so happy that this deal got struck for the, you know, for the women's team. Because if you are one of the people who pays attention and not pays attention simply to the narrative of how this was sold through the press releases, they fought their asses off to get this. Been fighting for this for a long time. And that includes the hockey team. Let's not forget that the women's national hockey team, they were going to skip the Worlds and they were being played in the United States in order to get the equity and the equality that they deserved. And you think about all of these different battles that take place. And sure, there is a narrative that is constant and is annoying, that you know, that women's basketball was elevated simply because Kobe Bryant took an interest in it. And so suddenly women's basketball, the WNBA, became the Kobe Bryant show. And because it was the Kobe Bryant show, then all the other male players started to sit there and rep women's sports because Kobe did it and he was the Mamba. And it's like, okay, and now everyone is sort of looking for their, you know, male sponsor. And that's bullshit, right? That's not what's happening. What's happening is that what you get because you fight for it. And let's not ever lose sight of the fight that took, that the lonely fight. And on top of the lonely fight, when you're talking about it from a standpoint of, say, equal pay in tennis, the men were equally, were outwardly, obviously hostile to this idea. They have been hostile. They're still hostile to it. However, over time, you lose that battle when you keep, you know, when the opposition keeps fighting. And then all of a sudden the opposition wants to exploit it and say, hey, yeah, I'm in. I've always been in on women's sports. It's great. And now you got a whole bunch of dudes out there tweeting WNBA scores and the women's Final Four and all of that. But let's also not forget that this is nonsense. That the if this was the cool thing to do, then the NCAA would have allowed women to use the term March Madness for their tournament for all this time, and they didn't. So it's up to you, Kate, right? It's up to these storytellers to tell the story and to keep the story straight. That is another episode of Metalarkers. We will see you when we see you. Amin's not here, but we thank him anyway. Kate Fagan, good to see you again.
Thanks, Aaron.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yeah! The Vandercoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.